Today is Wednesday, January 28th. We're going to be working through more endocrine today with thyroid and parathyroid glands.
Okay, so last week we talked about mechanisms for hormone action. We know that hormones fall into two categories. They're either proteins or they are what? Lipids, yeah, or steroids, okay? Now, what is the mechanism that most proteins use to talk to their target cells? Secondary messenger, good. In the case of secondary messenger, the hormone behaves as your first messenger. Inside your cell, what behaves as your second messenger?
CAMP.
CAMP, good. And so CAMP turns on an enzyme called kinases, good. Protein kinases, good. Okay, so there's an exception to the rule. There is a protein hormone that does not use the secondary messenger system, and that one is thyroxine, good. So it happens to use the alternate mechanism, which is direct gene activation. So most steroids use direct gene activation, and what does that mean? How are we changing the cellular activity? Goes into the cell, turns on protein synthesis, good, good. So most steroids that are made by adrenal glands, sex hormones that come from the gonads, all use that direct gene activation mechanism. Let's see, we also talked a little bit last week about different ways to stimulate glands to release their hormones. We talked about humoral, hormonal, and neural stimulation. Which of those three involves changing levels of ions or nutrients in the blood?
Humoral,
good. Let's see, if we're talking about one hormone from one gland activating the release of hormones from another gland, that is?
Hormonal,
good. And with neural stimulation, what is stimulating the release of hormones? Nervous system, yeah. So typically it's something like sympathetic or parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, so today we're going to work with the thyroid gland, and that's going to be found on page 9 in your course pack. So the thyroid gland is located in your neck, wrapped around what?
Trachea,
good. Some people describe it as a bow tie, others describe it as a butterfly, but the point is it does not cover the back side of your trachea, it just wraps the front and the sides of your trachea. You'll notice the thyroid cartilage sitting here, and it's right up underneath that thyroid cartilage. Everybody's got thyroid cartilage, it's just more pronounced in males, and in that case we call it an Adam's apple. So if you feel for the little bumpy part of your trachea, that's probably your thyroid cartilage. Feel right beneath there, that is your fleshy thyroid gland wrapped around your trachea. Not to be confused with your thymus gland. Your thymus gland is in your chest over your heart. A lot of times people get these two confused, but they're totally different in terms of location and function. This little piece in the middle is a connector. It's called the isthmus, and it connects the two pieces that sit on either side of your trachea. Okay. This interesting gland is the largest purely endocrine gland, which means that it has no other function than to make hormones. And so what are the hormones made by your thyroid gland? Good. T3, T4, and calcitonin. Good. T3, T4, and calcitonin. Good. Just wanted to make a point here. We're talking about an endocrine gland, so there are no ducts or tubes here. What types of glands do have ducts or tubes?
Exocrine.
Exocrine, right. So there was no ducts or tubes in this picture of a thyroid. In fact, what you're looking at is a setup of colloid, which is a gel-like substance, and the surrounding cells. So the cells here are often called follicle or follicular cells. And these cells secrete a specific set of hormones. Thyroid hormones are made by your follicle cells. That does include T3 and T4. Interesting thing about thyroid hormone, you can store it for around 30 days in that jelly-like substance called the colloid. So you've got an instantly available supply in that colloid space. Now, play along with my imagination here. I think I see beaches and I see lakes. and the lakes are the colloid, and the surrounding beaches are the follicle cells. See how that works? Okay? These cells in the background are not follicle cells. They don't sit on the beach, so to speak. Those are called parafollicle cells. They make a completely different type of hormone, not thyroid hormones. Those parafollicle cells make calcitonin. So that's a blank there for you to fill in your sheet. Parafollicle cells make calcitonin. All right, so we store thyroid hormones in the colloid, not calcitonin. We store the thyroid hormones there for about 30 days. Do you think there's an advantage of having a 30-day supply? If you need it, you got it, right? Okay, so on a really cold day where you need to increase your BMR, then you've got a supply you can tap into sitting right there in that colloid. So don't have to wait for your body to make the thyroid hormone. You can just tap into that supply. Let's talk about the thyroid hormones for a moment. These thyroid hormones are actually two types. One is called thyroxine, or T4, and its buddy is called T3, and the long name is triiodothyronine. Okay, so the 3 and the 4 indicates how many iodine atoms are housed in each of those thyroid hormones. So if you prefer, you can call them T3 and T4. It's certainly a lot easier to say than the long names there. You guys see the bouncing screen? It's driving me nuts. They had HVAC problems in the ceiling, and I think they didn't get them fixed because the screen continues to bounce. So I'm hoping by next week that'll be gone. Do you see it vibrating?
Yeah.
It's just raw.
What did you say the number stands for?
The number stands for the number of iodine atoms. So obviously 4 in T4 and 3 iodines in T3. I'll come back to calcitonin. Let's spend some time right now with T4 and T3. So T4 is the more common thyroid hormone. It is the one that's more commonly stored in your colloid. It is the one that is released and in circulation in your body. So it only differs from T3, though, by one iodine atom. And so you may recall that thyroxine is a little different. It is a protein hormone, but it enters cells and binds with an intracellular receptor. And so when it comes into the cell, it actually drops off an iodine atom, and then it becomes T3 once it's inside the cell. So the T3 is actually a more potent form of thyroid hormone, and it is less common, interestingly. So it only is available, or mostly available, at the site of conversion in our cells. So this is a set of hormonally controlled hormones, and the control originates where? Hypothalamus, good. TRH stands for what?
Thyroid
releasing hormone, good. Thyroid releasing hormone targets the anterior pituitary. In turn, what does the anterior pituitary release?
Thyroid stimulating.
Good, the stimulating hormone then targets your thyroid gland. The thyroid gland typically produces more thyroxine than it does triiodothyronine, or T3. So T4 thyroxine is the more common of those two. Now, let's say that it's really cold outside. You know, we're not having a cold day today, but let's say it was like 20 degrees, 30 degrees outside. Your body would be constantly trying to stay warm if you were outside on a really cold day. That requires more thyroxine to maintain your basal metabolic rate. If you have low thyroxine levels, how do you get more of them? There's a feedback loop, right? The feedback loop tells your brain make more TRH, and then TRH tells your anterior pituitary what? Make more TSH, and TSH tells your thyroid gland make more thyroxine, yeah. So if you can get the levels up to where they need to be, you know, certainly you can tap into the colloid, but this mechanism ensures there's still going to be enough in circulation and in supply in that colloid. So this is a negative feedback loop that operates to maintain proper levels of thyroxine, or T4, in circulation. So the big job here is to regulate metabolism. How would you define metabolism? You know it if you've got it, right? If you've got a good metabolism, you feel good. If you don't have a good metabolism, you feel awful. Metabolism is all of your body's chemical reactions. It's how your body builds new cells and tissues and how your body breaks down things, including food for digestion. So your metabolic rate, your basal metabolic rate, is regulated by thyroxine or T4. Okay. Another interesting point about thyroxine, it also helps to maintain growth and development, especially as we're growing up as kids. I don't want to use the word growth and confuse you here, because there's another really big hormone that does growth. That one's what? Growth hormone, yes. So I don't want to confuse you and use the word growth and have you think growth hormone. Growth hormone does not regulate metabolism like this one does. Growth hormone just does growth. But thyroxine and its buddy T3 do encourage growth and development, especially in our younger days when we're growing up as kids. So let me tell you how this works. The main hormone produced by your follicle cells is T4. When T4 is released from the follicle cells, it hops in the bloodstream with an escort. And the escort is called a transport protein. So it's kind of like it gets in its little car, it binds to the transport protein, and the transport protein is called thyroglobulin. Well, thyroglobulin transports thyroxine around your body. When it gets to a target cell, it dumps it off, and at the target cell, thyroxine or T4 is converted down to T3. It takes one of those iodine atoms and it says, get off, you're done. And so now we've got the more potent form, which is T3. So interesting to note that T3 is more potent. It just happens to be less common than T4. Okay, so if we were to run a blood test on you, we should see something like 80% of your thyroid hormone coming from T4 and something like 20% coming from T3. So T3 is potent, it just happens to be a less common form of the thyroid hormone. So you kind of get a feel here for all the things that potentially could go wrong. If you have thyroid problems, you could have problems that originate from TRH to TSH, to the communication of thyroxine production, to its transport in the bloodstream attached to thyroglobulin, to its conversion point to T3. So it is interesting to note that a lot of people, especially women, have thyroid problems. Not a surprise, right? Look at all that can go wrong with this particular hormone. Just checking. Anybody still need the slide? Y'all good? On the right-hand side of your sheet, I've got some thyroid disorders listed for you. And we're going to talk through the hypothyroid problems first. And then we'll talk through the hyperthyroid problems. So the hypo prefix means what? Below normal. Good. So hypothyroidism means we don't have enough thyroxine. Hyperthyroidism means we have excess. All right, so we're looking at myxedema and cretinism as two forms of hypothyroidism. Hyperthyroidism, you'll notice we've got Graves' disease, and then oddly, goiter sits in both categories. Goiter can form symptoms for a person that fall toward the hypo side, or they may in fact fall toward the hyper side, so it just depends on the nature of the goiter. Why don't we talk through the hypothyroidism problems first? Let's start off with myxedema. And you look at the word, and it looks kind of as a strange word, but it does have the word edema built in there. And what happens to us when we have edema?
Swelling.
Swelling, right. Excess fluid in the interstitial space is swelling. And in fact, if you have low basal metabolic rate, then we do experience swelling from that. So we'll look at a picture of someone with that swelling. This is an extreme case of hypothyroidism in an adult, and it causes a lot of really characteristic symptoms. The least of your problems would be hair loss and dry skin. The bigger problems are things like the bone numbing fatigue, not being able to think clearly, and other stuff like heart rate can be affected, and even a bit of weight gain. So we're looking at big problems here from having a very slow metabolic rate. I don't have myxedema, but I do have hypothyroidism that's controlled with medication. Females are commonly the ones diagnosed with hypothyroidism. Very common thing that can pop up, especially if you're subjected to stress. So you may be working along fine, may have a really stressful event, and then you feel like you just can't recover from it. And a lot of women get tested and realize that they have some form of hypothyroidism. You'll notice in these pictures that the people do have swelling around the face. It looks kind of like weight gain, but in fact it can be controlled with some type of hormone like Synthroid or Unithroid. And the increase in basal metabolic rate helps to reduce the swelling. So this man's a good example. Notice it took away the swelling around his facial features. All right, let's see. This particular condition is not an adult issue, it's more of a kid's issue. And congenital hyperthyroidism is also known as cretinism. So the problem is, it's not just a metabolic rate that's affected. What else is affected in somebody who has this?
The size,
yeah. The way their body grows, their development is affected. Yes, yeah, so they're going to be a dwarf in terms of size. So you'll notice there's a lot of symptoms that sound like dwarfism, an underdeveloped body, muscles and bones that don't grow. The thick skin comes from not enough basal metabolic rate, not enough metabolism to make the skin grow and slough off like it normally does. But there's one thing that distinguishes this particular form of dwarfism from pituitary dwarfism, and that's the mental retardation factor. Thyroid hormone is also important for your central nervous system to grow. So without having an ample level of thyroxine, we see mental retardation that can set in by the time a person reaches the teenage years. So this is such an important hormone. Babies, very first day of life, get holes poked in them, they take their blood, they check and see if they've got adequate thyroxine levels. And if they don't, they start them on some type of supplement from day one. So this is a way for us to eliminate this disorder nowadays. So this is cretinism. You'll notice the characteristic facial features. These are three different people. But you'll notice the lack of thyroxine simply means their facial features didn't grow, neither did the rest of the body. All right, so he's about 4 feet tall. Okay. This girl is 16 years old. She looks like a toddler. And this was in a textbook I picked up in a thrift store. It was an A&P textbook from the 1950s. Fascinating because back then this was a case study. This girl had not gone through puberty at age 16, and look how tiny she was. They gave her thyroxine injections, and notice after 2 years of growth, she'd grown quite a bit, and she'd also gone through puberty. So we do know that thyroxine is very important for normal growth and metabolism, and also for, you know, the development of the body as a kid. This also makes an important point. What is the point of thyroxine? What does it do for sex hormones? You don't have thyroxine, are you going to go through puberty? Nope. And so it tells us that thyroxine is permissive for sex hormones. It has to be present in order for those sex hormones to do their jobs. So her ovaries may have been ready to go through puberty all along, but without thyroxine, they weren't able to have that jump start or that permission needed to make her body go through that transformation. So a really fascinating case. By age 18, her central nervous system is well on its way to being fully developed. I don't know if they were able to do anything for any kind of mental deficiencies that she might have had by that age. That's pretty far along. We lose brain plasticity after age 16. So not a lot of changes can occur after the mid-teenage years. Let's see. We looked at this picture last week. The person on the far left is considered to be a congenital hypothyroid person. Notice a normal-sized torso, but the rest of his body didn't keep pace with growing. I want to make the point because these two people are pituitary dwarfs. So theirs is not a thyroxine problem. What is actually their condition? Not enough growth hormone, yeah. So look how it made their bodies grow differently. They look like kids. Their bodies are just very small all over. But that distinguishes it from a thyroid condition. So thyroid condition, These two have growth hormone deficiencies. These two have neither thyroid nor growth hormone problems. They have what's called a chondroplasia. So if you've ever seen the Little People Big World show on TLC, they have a chondroplasia on that show. And unfortunately, achondroplasiacs have growth plates that do not respond to growth hormone. So you could take those two and say, all right, we're going to give you growth hormone injections, and it really wouldn't do much for their growth overall. The way to make their bodies grow bigger is a really painful way, and that is to install a set of screws and plates in their legs, break the femur along the shaft, and then crank. Every few days or every few weeks, they crank again, and it keeps forcing the bone to be deposited in the middle of the shaft. And that's the way they get them to get taller, because those growth plates just don't respond to hormones. So, ouch. Okay, let's talk about goiter for just a minute. Ever seen someone with goiter? Very common condition. It looks like a swelling of the neck. And this is why the neck swells when a person has a goiter. Thyroid hormone needs iodine. You know, T4 requires 4 iodine atoms, T3 only requires 3. And if you don't have enough iodine due to either a deficiency or a metabolism problem, that gland gets bigger and bigger, trying to concentrate the iodine in the bloodstream. And so the goiter can actually squeeze off your trachea. What do you think some of the symptoms are that you might experience if you have a goiter?
Trouble breathing.
Trouble breathing.
Swallowing.
Possibly talking.
Talking, yeah. Yeah, sense of hoarseness, maybe feeling like a throat's being squeezed, talking would be difficult. So it can unfortunately swell to be a quite large growth around the entire neck, front and sides. I'll go ahead and show you what it looks like. So these are some pretty worst case scenarios. You know, they can treat this. They can give you iodine and hopefully that'll make it go down. They can give you medications like thyroid medications, like Synthroid, Unithroid, those kinds of things. If that doesn't work, they can do surgery. This person here has had a surgical scar due to the removal of the thyroid gland. So, yeah, it can become a real bad situation where it swells larger and larger around the neck area. So we are fortunate to not live in the goiter belt. The goiter belt is this shaded area along the northern part of the United States. We have soils down here that have iodine in them, which is good news. If you eat locally grown foods, they have iodine from the soils. If you eat fish from our lakes and rivers, if you eat fish from the ocean, you've got a good source of iodine there as well. So most likely, if you have a goiter around this area, it's not necessarily due to an iodine deficiency as much as it would be a metabolism issue. Now, the northern part of the United States, they ate fish, they ate soil-grown foods locally, and they had goiter still because neither soil nor water had enough iodine. So about 100 years ago, they figured out a real easy way to help out those people, and they had to iodize our salt. So when you go to the grocery store, take a look. I know now you're going to be crawling on that bottom shelf where they store the salt, but they do sell both iodized and non-iodized salt. Okay? And so you may say, well, why in the heck would I want the non-iodized salt? Is there any reason why you might want to purchase that one? Could be allergic to iodine, yep. What else could cause you?
Too much iodine.
Yeah, if you've got too much iodine, what might happen with your thyroid? Hyperthyroidism, exactly. So, yeah, there are cases where people may want to have non-iodized salt. So they in fact do sell the non-iodized version in the store. So if you happen to have a goiter that causes a hypo set of symptoms, then giving iodine could be one way to help solve the problem, or giving supplemental thyroid hormone is another way to solve the problem. But sometimes people have goiter symptoms that lean more toward the hyperthyroidism end of the category. And in that case, they may surgically remove the thyroid gland, or they may in fact use a radioactive iodine pill to kill the thyroid tissue. So why radioactive iodine? Why not fluorine or chlorine or some other element?
It would not be absorbed.
Exactly. Iodine has to be the one. it's the one taken up and absorbed by the thyroid gland. So yeah, that's one way to work it. Unfortunately, in the last two conditions, you may end up on medication anyway because we have to regulate thyroid hormone production. All right. So let's swing toward the opposite direction. The opposite end of the spectrum is hyperthyroidism. What does that mean? Too much, yeah, too much thyroxine. So what happens to your basal metabolic rate? Goes up, yeah. So these are an unfortunate set of symptoms. Imagine running at the top of your speed. You know how your heart's racing, you're wide awake, you're alert, your breathing is up, and then sitting down and still experiencing those same symptoms. That's kind of what it's like to be hyperthyroid. You'll notice the increased heart rate there. Tachycardia is a big one. We also see sweating. We also see things like bulging eyes that come along with this particular condition. So I know the weight loss sounds like a great plan for this particular one, but the tachycardia can wear out your heart and kill a person. So I'll give you a quick and easy way to remember this one. Because tachycardia is so bad for your heart, it can put you in the grave, Graves' disease, okay? So this particular form of hyperthyroidism means that you're just running with excess thyroxine. It can wear out your heart over time. So you'll notice all bunch of symptoms here, everything from difficulty sleeping to a fast and irregular heartbeat rate, weight loss, that sounds like a good deal, but not with these symptoms, and heat insensitivity. Now, this particular setup means that your tissues are all growing at a faster rate, and where it really becomes a problem are the tissues that are behind your eyes. So the connective tissue that pads the back of your eye socket grows faster and pushes your eyes out of your eye socket. What kind of problem do you think that can cause? Dry eyes, yeah, really bad problems with eyes. That is an exophthalmos condition, and it looks like this, okay? And so these people actually look pretty good. This is what it really looks like. Yeah, so unfortunately, your eyes can get infected, the corneas can dry out, we have problems with vision. This lady is actually local. She had to have her eyes sewn shut just so that she could get some recovery there. Really bad situation, but you know, these people certainly don't have the issues that she had with exophthalmos. It is not a reversible condition. So if the thyroid gets so high and so bad, you're stuck with this situation where the eyes are pushed out of the eye sockets. All right, so we've talked about most of those. How about questions so far on Graves' disease?
Is it hereditary?
I think to some extent it may run in families, but it can come from things like thyroid cancers or nodules or even chemicals that we're exposed to. Okay. Any questions on cretinism or Graves? All right, why don't we go and talk about the other thyroid hormone, which is calcitonin. So this particular one has nothing to do with metabolism. This particular one is a calcium regulating hormone. Now, keep in mind, it is not produced by your follicle cells. It is produced where instead? Hair follicle cells, good. Is this one stored in the colloid? Nah, this one's not. What hormones are stored in the colloid? Yeah, T3, T4, yeah, thyroid hormones. So calcitonin is made on demand, and it's made on demand in response to changing blood calcium levels. So for that reason, we say this one is a humorally controlled hormone. Okay, it's under humoral control. This particular hormone seems to be most active in kids growing up. They say that once we reach adulthood, they can't find a lot of evidence that we actually make a lot of calcitonin. So they say in little kids that are growing, you know, little kids, they encourage to drink milk or have calcium-enriched foods. That's because osteoblasts are activated by calcitonin. Those osteoblasts build new bone. So it may be bone growing in length, or it may in fact be bone growing in width. But nonetheless, we do tend to see this particular hormone more active during our childhood growing years. So the point here is, calcitonin responds to high blood calcium levels. It lowers blood calcium by depositing that excess to our bones. All right. So this one is under what type of control?
Humoral.
Good. And that means what? Yeah. Calcium in the blood makes this one be released from your thyroid gland. Good. So it's completely under humoral control. There's no hormones here in control of this one. All right, so that should do it for that, page 9. How about questions so far? Let's see, at the top of the page, calcitonin is right. I'm going to pass the attendance roster. Is anybody new today? Okay, just make sure it gets around to y'all before you leave. All right, so top of page 11 has the parathyroid glands. So where are the parathyroids located? Around the thyroid, right, back side of the thyroid. There's somewhere between 4 and 8 little nodules of tissue back there, and it is their job to make one hormone. So you deserve an easy one. This is the easy one. And parathyroid hormone is made by the parathyroid glands. Okay, so pretty easy one. You know, sometimes people have their thyroid glands removed for various reasons. Maybe it's a case of hyperthyroidism that cannot be controlled. The surgeon that takes out the thyroid gland should be very careful to leave behind the parathyroid glands. They may not know until days or weeks after the surgery that they may have accidentally taken out the parathyroid glands. If they do that, you've got big trouble. So, of course, we've got calcitonin made by the thyroid, parathyroid hormone made by the parathyroid gland. Those are the only two hormones that regulate what? Calcium, yeah. So if you take out both thyroid and parathyroid, you've now lost all ability to maintain calcium levels in your bloodstream. I know, so think back to Bio-210. Why is calcium important for muscles? Muscle contraction. If you don't have enough calcium, what happens to your muscles? Yeah, you can't use them, right? They're not going to be strong enough to contract. And so that's some of the symptoms people see who have their parathyroids removed accidentally. They see problems with muscle contraction, and they see problems with their heart. Low calcium can be a problem for the heart. All right, so what do you think? Hormonal, humoral, or neural stimulation here? Humoral, okay? So what prods the release of PTH from the parathyroid glands?
Decreasing
calcium levels, right. What is the function of parathyroid hormone?
Increased
calcium, good. Now, does calcitonin do the same thing as PTH or opposite to PTH?
Opposite,
good. Are they synergists or antagonists? They're antagonists. Good. So there's your blank. The antagonist to PTH is calcitonin. So let's walk through the next issue here. Breastfeeding and its relationship with PTH production. So a mom who's given birth to a newborn baby and is breastfeeding that baby's milk requires calcium that's stolen away from mom's bones and mom's teeth. And so in order to maintain mom's calcium levels, which hormone raises blood calcium? PTH, yeah. So PTH goes to mom's bones and breaks them down. liberates that calcium into mom's bloodstream, and of course, that blood calcium now becomes part of the breast milk given to the baby. So what do you think happens to mom's bones during the time that she's breastfeeding? More brittle, yeah. They become leached from their calcium. And in fact, they say that women lose 2-3% of their skeleton during the time that they breastfeed that can only be replaced once they stop and start returning to, you know, normal diet. There's an old saying that goes, for every child a tooth is lost, and that's related to the fact that PTH not only will take the calcium from the bones, it'll take it from the teeth. So, you know, back before we had, you know, fairly good nutrition, people lost teeth, women had cavities, and unfortunately that's because the calcium was being given to the baby. So, yeah, breastfeeding can actually do a number on your bones and your teeth.
Is that why pregnant women have such a hard time with their teeth?
It starts leaching away the calcium, yeah.
And I know one girl that she had, her teeth were perfect, and then when she got pregnant, it's like it hurt, she started getting cavities.
I've heard the cavities thing more commonly nowadays, but yeah.
Even one girl said her teeth got chipped because of it.
Not surprised. Yeah, and I've heard of people even having their molars fall
so
out.
So I always wondered about what caused that.
Yeah, babies are still in the calcium. Interesting to note that you don't have to get calcium from the bones. You've got other places you can get it from too, but the bones certainly are a good storage bank for it. You know, your kidneys are filtering blood and getting rid of waste products as urine. Calcium could in fact be something that we discard in our urine, but if PTH is present in your kidneys, they're going to keep that calcium and reclaim it back into the bloodstream. Likewise, the foods that you eat may also contain a lot of calcium. Your intestines are another target area for PTH. You can reclaim calcium, of course, from your intestines too. Interesting scan. This is a person with the head lean back, and those four little dark spots are the parathyroid sitting around the thyroid gland. This is a case of hyperparathyroidism. So just imagine that you have too much parathyroid hormone. What's that going to do to your bones? Strip them down. Good. What is that going to do to your kidneys? Well, keeping more calcium. And what is that going to tell your intestines to do? Keep more calcium. Okay, so take a look at the problems. Often associated with hyperparathyroidism are stones, bones, groans, and moans. That means that we have kidney stones if we have hyperparathyroidism because our kidneys keep too much calcium. Our bones are brittle because we're leaching out the calcium into our bloodstream. Osteoclasts break those bones down. Why do we have the groans and the moans? Say that again?
Your
skeleton holds your body up. Yeah, and if it's being broken down, you've got problems, right? And why is calcium needed for muscles? For contraction. If you have too much calcium, what do muscles do? They contract a lot, don't they? So that can cause the heart to have problems. It can cause skeletal muscle to have problems. So unfortunately, it gives you a really achy setup. Increased calcium can also cause psychiatric problems because it increases the availability of neurotransmitters, so it makes more transmitter available at those synaptic clefts. So, yeah, excess PTH is a really bad situation. It affects a lot of stuff in your body. Okay, so that should take care of parathyroid hormone. How about questions there? Let's review where we've been so far. What are the two types of hormones made by your thyroid gland?
T3 and T4.
T3, T4, and calcitonin. Good. What is the antagonist to calcitonin?
PTH.
Good. That stands for?
Parathyroid.
Parathyroid hormone. Good. Let's see. Which set of cells make your thyroid hormones in your thyroid gland? Follicle cells. And your parafollicular cells make? Calcitonin, which happens to be an antagonist to
PTH.
Catch the little similarity in wording here. Calcitonin is made by parafollicle cells, which happens to be an antagonist to parathyroid hormone. So if you get confused as to which cells make which sets of hormones, keep the para stuff in line. That may help you keep that straight. Go ahead.
Can you say that one more time?
Sure.
Follicle cells make
T3, T4. Is that the part you needed to hear?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. So what hormone is turned on by TRH? TSH. Yeah, where's TSH made?
Anterior pituitary.
Anterior pituitary. Now what hormones are turned on by TSH? T3, T4, or thyroxine, triiodothyronine. Okay. Does calcitonin need a hormone to activate it? No, because it is controlled how? Humoral. Good. How is parathyroid hormone controlled?
Levels of
calcium levels in the blood, also humoral, right? Okay. Let's see. What is the name of the hormone that turns on adrenal gland hormones? ACTH, good. And what hormone activates ACTH release? CRH, good. Okay. So that's where we're headed next, is to the adrenals. Before we head there, do y'all have any questions so far? Everything clicking so far? Anything I can clarify for you? Okay. We'll see how far we can go with the adrenals. We're going to start on page 12. So the adrenal glands are found toward the kidney. That's what adrenal means, is toward the kidney. And in fact, each kidney has an adrenal gland sitting on top. So your blank at the very top of the page, these glands are found on tops of the kidneys. Okay, so you got one on each kidney. Each adrenal gland has two regions. There is an outermost region called the adrenal cortex. There's an innermost, deeper region called the adrenal medulla or medulla. Let's tackle the adrenal cortex first. There's three zones or layers here, and we're going to start with the outermost zona glomerulosa. That outermost zona glomerulosa makes a set of hormones, or a class of hormones, that are called mineral corticoids. Okay, the term mineral corticoid indicates a class or group of hormones. Let's pick out the good clues that are built in here, starting with the suffix of corticoid. Corticoid tells you two things. One, I am made by the adrenal cortex. You know what the second clue is? Are these hormones protein-based or steroid-based? Steroid, yeah. So corticoid, second clue, I'm a steroid hormone. Okay, so corticoids are steroids. Let's tackle the first part of that word, mineral. Well, that's what we're regulating in the bloodstream. So we're regulating mineral content of the blood. That gives me images of rocks in my blood, which is so not right. What the real thing is that we're regulating here is salt, okay? So when we say mineral corticoids, we actually mean we're regulating salt content in the bloodstream. now we got a good set of clues. We'll notice the next set are produced by the zona fasciculata. That middle layer produces a set called the glucocorticoids. Corticoid says I'm made by the adrenal cortex and I'm a steroid. And so this particular set of hormones doesn't regulate salt content, it regulates sugar. Good. Gluco means sugar. The last category are called your gonadocorticoids. Built-in clues say I am made by the adrenal cortex and I am a steroid hormone and I regulate the gonads. So in males and females, these sex hormones regulate male testes and female ovaries. Sure, the gonadocorticoids produce sex hormones, and their goal is to regulate male testes and female ovaries. So, if you didn't know that men make estrogen, right? Okay, and women make testosterone, that's where it's made. Yeah, so interesting to note that both males and females make a little bit of both sex hormones. That comes from the adrenal cortex. I don't know if you can see really well here, but there are three distinctive layers of the adrenal cortex. Each layer should make a separate type of hormone. From the outside, we regulate salt, and then sugar, and then sex. And in fact, that's one way to keep it straight. Those are the three things that our adrenal cortex regulates. Salt, sugar, and sex. So, had they put this in a different order, it actually would have matched up with our layers, wouldn't it? They should have put salt first, because that is in fact what the outermost layer makes, and then sugar, and then of course sex is made by that deepest layer. The teddy bears kill me. All right, let's talk about our new best friend. I told you about ADH last class period. We're going to review that one, of course, and then we're going to talk about our second new best friend for the semester. Last week, we talked about a hormone called antidiuretic hormone. For short, it is ADH. Where is it made? Hypothalamus, and it's stored and released from... posterior pituitary, good. ADH targets what part of your body?
Kidneys,
good. And it tells your kidneys to keep and retain?
Water,
good. What influence does ADH have on blood pressure?
Keeps it up,
good. So we help to maintain blood pressure, thank you to ADH, and also thanks to aldosterone. These two are really similar. They have similar goals in helping to maintain blood pressure. They just do it in slightly different ways. Keep in mind, aldosterone is a type of mineral corticoid. Tell me what mineral corticoid means to you. Salt, it's a steroid hormone. It's made, adrenal cortex. So it is a salt-regulating hormone. It comes from the adrenal cortex. And hey, another great clue, O-N-E at the ending there tells you again, I am a steroid. Cortisone, progesterone, testosterone, aldosterone all have that O-N-E ending that again says, I am a steroid. So a lot of similarities between ADH and aldosterone. Of course, both target the kidneys. Both play a role in maintaining blood pressure. But notice, because it is a mineral corticoid, we know its main job is to regulate salt in the bloodstream. And by salt, we specifically mean sodium and potassium levels. So what this particular hormone does is it tells your kidneys to retain sodium, which is going to be our salt. Now, thinking back to when you discovered osmosis and you talked about how water moves, water always followed what? Water always followed salt. So if your kidneys are keeping sodium or salt, you also keep water, okay? And so the more water you have in your bloodstream, the higher your blood pressure is going to go. So that is another big issue here. Aldosterone also helps to regulate blood pressure. It is an extremely important blood pressure regulating hormone. Now there's a trick. If you keep sodium, you're actually going to pee out and urinate away excess potassium. So there's an exchange that takes place. If you keep the sodium, you dump the potassium. You remember this sodium-potassium pump, right? Okay. You may have discussed it with muscle and nerve function. And this particular pump is going to maintain ion concentration in the bloodstream. How many sodiums does that pump keep?
Three.
And how many potassiums does it dump?
Two.
Just two. Right. So this is the pump that's inserted in the kidney tubules. It allows us to keep sodium and water, and in exchange, we dump out and urinate away potassium. Okay? So aldosterone keeps sodium, gets rid of potassium. So let's talk about an example. If you get up in the morning, you're extremely busy, you don't have a chance to eat or drink anything, you come to school, you go to work, you don't have an opportunity to drink all morning, it's one of those crazy days, and it may be lunchtime before you take your first sip of anything for the day. So your body is trying to maintain blood pressure, and one way it does it is by releasing aldosterone. You'll notice that low blood pressure is a stimulus or a trigger for the release of aldosterone. So on those days where you're really busy and you don't drink and eat properly, do you notice your urine output? Do you pee a lot? And when you do pee, what color is it? Dark yellow, right? And it's just a small volume of urine. So what's happening to the water that should have been in that urine? Being held on to. Yeah, you're keeping it. And who's telling your kidneys to keep it? Aldosterone, yeah. And so the way aldosterone encourages water retention is it says, hey, sodiums, come back from the urine into the bloodstream. And then by keeping those sodium ions, what also follows? Water. Yeah, so we keep the water, we keep the salt. And in exchange, what do you urinate away? Potassium, right. So it's just an exchange to maintain ion balance in the body. Let's see, when in terms of blood volume and blood pressure go hand in hand. So if you don't eat or drink, you're gonna have low blood volume and low blood pressure. There's a number of reasons we could have low blood sodium. Diarrhea can give you low blood sodium, for instance, or excessive sweating can give you low blood sodium, or simply not eating and drinking enough or enough of the right things can give you low blood sodium. So any of those conditions that promote low blood sodium are going to give you a stimulus for aldosterone's release. Notice the last one, though. High blood potassium levels can also stimulate aldosterone. So when aldosterone is present in your kidneys, what two things do you keep? Sodium and water, and you pee away
potassium.
Yeah, so in the case of having excess potassium, that may be another encouragement for aldosterone's release. So excess potassium is bad for us. It can cause your heart to stop. It can kill us. It can come from things like kidney problems where you have a buildup of potassium in the bloodstream. So excess potassium is certainly something we want to dump and get rid of. Okay. So this is an interesting hormone. Everything we've covered up to this point has pretty much a clean cut, clear and simple control mechanism. For instance, what stimulates parathyroid hormone's release? Calcium levels, good. What stimulates thyroxine's release? TSH, yeah. What stimulates the release of growth hormone?
HGH.
GHRH, good. So everything has been clear cut. There's been one answer, right? Okay, so when I ask the question, what stimulates aldosterone's release, it is not one simple answer. It's four answers, okay? So this is a new one for us. We haven't encountered one that's kind of complicated, but there are four things that will trigger the release of aldosterone. Now, the most important stimulus is the first one. That one is called the renin-angiotensin aldosterone mechanism, okay? That is the most important way to control the release of aldosterone. All right, so what part of your body filters blood? Kidneys, good. The kidneys kind of are on the front lines of knowing what's happening with your blood and your blood pressure. So if you have not drank or eat anything today, your kidneys know because your blood pressure is low. And so if your blood pressure is low, you can't filter blood adequately and you can't get rid of all those waste products that build up in your bloodstream. So the kidneys say, hey, this is a warning for us because we need to have high enough pressure to be able to get rid of all these waste products. That turns on the renin-angiotensin aldosterone mechanism. And so in fact, low blood pressure is the stimulus for this mechanism. The kidneys are constantly monitoring your blood pressure, and if the blood pressure is too low, you'll notice the kidneys release a chemical called renin. All right? Look at this chain of command here. Where does renin go next? To the liver, and the liver makes and releases a chemical called angiotensin. Angio means vessel. What does tensin sound like?
Tension.
Tension, you like to squeeze, okay? And in fact, angiotensin squeezes blood vessels, and that term means it is a vasoconstrictor. If you squeeze your blood vessels, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up. You may say, hey, problem solved, right? We've got a vasoconstrictor here that's going to squeeze our vessels. Blood pressure goes up. But we actually didn't solve the real problem. If you've got low blood pressure, you probably also have low blood volume. So how do you get more water if you can't, won't, or don't drink? You keep what you've got, right? You don't pee, you keep the fluids instead. And so that's what angiotensin does, is it says to the adrenal cortex, hey, release the aldosterone. Aldosterone goes back to the kidney, and it tells the kidney to retain two things. What are they? And you pee out?
Potassium.
Okay, so this is a short-term fix for a problem. You know, eventually you're going to have to drink something, okay? But otherwise, this is a way to kind of fix the blood pressure issue until you can have an opportunity to drink. It's a 1-2 punch, okay? Aldosterone and angiotensin work together as a 1-2 punch. Angiotensin squeezes vessels and raises pressure. Aldosterone retains water and salt, which also raises pressure. So they work together to help increase pressure. Therefore, angiotensin and aldosterone are
synergists.
Yeah, they work together as synergists. Okay, so this is the number one control mechanism for aldosterone's release. In fact, it is such a potent and strong mechanism, they make medications to stop it. You know, I challenge you to find somebody who doesn't have blood pressure issues, right? Go home and ask the older people in your family. Anybody not have somebody with blood pressure issues, right? It's very hard to find somebody who's on the blood pressure medication. Blood pressure medications often do this. They come in here and they stop the release of angiotensin. And then what effect does that have on aldosterone? Yeah, no aldosterone means you're going to decrease levels. If you don't have enough aldosterone, do you keep water and salt? Nope. And so what happens to your blood pressure? Goes down, right? So you urinate away a bunch of your extra fluids and that helps you to maintain blood pressure. So this mechanism here is a really potent mechanism in maintaining blood pressure. Okay, let's see. These other mechanisms are lesser important, but nonetheless they can encourage aldosterone's release. So sodium levels and potassium levels can also release aldosterone. Let's be specific. Is it low sodium or high sodium? Low sodium. Yeah, if you don't have enough sodium, you probably don't have enough water. So low sodium will trigger aldosterone's release. What about potassium? Low levels or high levels? High levels, because high levels can kill us. It can make our heart stop. So we've got to get aldosterone to let us pee out and urinate away that excess potassium. And interesting, ACTH can also play a role here. So where is ACTH made? Anterior, good. And it gets its command from the hypothalamus, which releases CRH, good. So ultimately, hormonal control can also play a role in aldosterone's release. But the number one most potent mechanism is that renin-angiotensin mechanism. Is your brain awash with information? This is the most confusing one to get straight. So, just as a side note, I did want to mention this to you. You know, you often hear that stress increases your blood pressure, and this is how it happens. If you're under stress, the hypothalamus is the one to be stressed out, and hypothalamus will then hypersecrete CRH. That's corticotropic releasing hormone. What is the target of CRH? Anterior, yeah. So anterior pituitary now hypersecretes ACTH, which is adrenocorticotropic hormone. AC is our clue there because that's where we're headed. ACTH tells the adrenal cortex to make extra hormones. That means extra aldosterone gets made. The more aldosterone you make, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up, yes. Yeah, so you retain more salt, more water, and you excrete more potassium, yeah. So they often say that if you're stressed for long periods of time to take a break, because this mechanism just gets hooked in an on position. And so that's one way to maintain high blood pressure, which is not necessarily what we want to do, right? So that's where taking those medications called angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors, ACE inhibitors, can actually shut off the release of aldosterone. So in some cases, we actually have to kind of interfere with that mechanism if you're under high blood pressure, stressful situations. Very bottom of your page is one hormone that works against aldosterone, and it's called AMP for short. Atrial natriuretic peptide is telling you everything you need to know. Atria indicates the heart. Natriuretic says sodium. Natrium is sodium. And you can see uretic in there means to produce urine. So I'm a hormone that's made in the heart. I get rid of sodium in the urine. And it just happens to be a peptide hormone, so that tells you it works by what mechanism?
Secondary messenger,
yeah. So interesting hormone here. It's produced when your heart muscle stretches. So when if you've got really high blood pressure, the walls of your heart stretch, and overstretching can cause them to tear. So AMP is released by the heart to help reduce the load on the heart. In turn, you urinate away the excess fluids, salt, and fat loads. This one happens to be an antagonist to aldosterone. It is the only hormone that lowers blood pressure. All right, so if you're keeping track, we have ADH that raises blood pressure, we've got aldosterone that raises blood pressure, and only one, AMP, that lowers blood pressure. So AMP is an antagonist to what? Aldosterone, yeah. It works against the blood pressure problem. Looks like we've made it to the bottom of the page. That's probably a pretty good place to stop. If you would like to hear all of this again on Monday, I'll be happy to review aldosterone. It's a trick to get straight. But if you feel comfortable Monday, we'll go ahead and start with the top of page 13. Okay, and then we'll work through pancreas information on Monday as well. Do y'all have any questions for today? Everybody get the sign-in sheet today? Okay, y'all have a good weekend.